My name's Dave. I'm alcoholic, and I'm very grateful for AA. I'm very grateful for NA. I'm grateful for all the A's and all of the above, and because I qualify for most of them. And as I say, my predominant thing is I identify as an alcoholic, but I pretty much know that I'm addicted to self. I'm addicted to anything outside of me. That's pretty much anything that tastes good or feels good or changes the way I feel. It pretty much, I want more of it. And I guess you could call me a moreish person, because I just want more and more of everything. If it makes me feel good, I get a hit, I want the rest of it. So it doesn't matter. And you know, and I've done most of the stuff that changes my mood and changes my my outlook, and gives me a short term hit. So that's the way I guess I'm identifying this, and it's great. You know, I believe that, well, I don't believe much, but I think that this is kind of the future of 12-step programs. I think that's pretty much where it's going to be. We're going to be sort of secular, and I think that's a good thing. And I think that the Zoom era has been a godsend. Wrong word. Has been a godsend. Has been a miracle. It has been, because it's certainly enhanced my sobriety. It's enhanced my quality of life, because it's basically given me access to a load of people such as yourselves from all over the world, and I'm just forever grateful that I have these 12-step programs. And you know, it's really helped me. It's made me address the big book again, and I've had to go and get the big book, and I've had a good read through the big book several times. I've done the steps again a couple of times in different fellowships. I'm also a member of Adult Children of Alcoholics of Alcoholics, as well as AA. And as I said, I qualify for all of them. But my mother died in 2020, at the end of 2020. She was a chronic alcoholic, and died a very, very miserable, awful death. And very cynical, awful death, you know, and it was one of those things that I had to cut myself off from her. I hadn't seen her in 15, 16 years, because of her addiction and because of her alcoholism. And she was living with a man who beat her regularly, and they would get drunk together, and it was awful. It was awful. It was an awful thing, and I had to stand by in the background and watch all this happening, because I did, you know, I tried to get her some kind of recovery. But you know, it was like when I suggested that she might want to get some help, you know, it was, how dare I even suggest that she was an alcoholic or an addict of some kind. So, you know, it was just one of those things, and we all know it. But it's a stark reminder, and I'm reminded of this disease. For me, most of my family are alcoholic or addict. My son is currently at the kind of the early flourishes or the early start of alcoholism or addiction. And I went to see him last night. I hadn't seen him in a few months. I'd been away in the States, and I went to see him last night, and you could tell he was stoned off his head. You know, it was one of those, the closed lids, you know, the half closed lids, and the kind of the smile on his face and stuff. And it's just stuff like that. And I don't pass comment anymore. I don't say anything, and I don't, because he's going to have to find his own way. And one of the things that's happened with Zoom is that I've been able to let go. I've been able to let go of a lot of stuff. And that's through doing the steps. I can't deny it. For me, doing the steps again and readdressing the steps has been amazing for me, because I've become a bit of a writer, and I write stuff out. And if there's anything, if I've got a pebble in my shoe about anything, about people, and mostly about people, then I write it out, and I try and find out what the story is and where that come from. And again, it's that step 6 and 7 for me is where when I find out. There's a chap in this room who helped me with this last year. And it's, if I write down and I find out exactly where the root of this issue comes from, be it from when I was 4 years old or when I was 44 years old, when I find out where the root of that is, I know that I've sort of entirely ready to have those defects removed. And for me, I had to do some kind of ritual, humbly asked for it to be removed, and I did some ritual, and you know what, it was removed. And I've had a lot of deforestation, a lot of deforestation over the past couple of years in terms of character defects and the way I go about my life. And I have to say, I'm traveling a lot lighter. I am traveling a hell of a lot lighter. And And I just recommend anyone to do it. If you haven't done it or you don't want to do it, and you can do it in your own, however you want to do it. But, and I'm always available if anyone ever wants to speak to me. I'm sure I'm very happy to talk to you about the way I've done it because it's helped me. Until the next, and the next lump of shit comes rolling my way and I have to deal with it. But for the moment, things are pretty good. And as a direct result of my mother dying, I found out I opened, took that rock out, took the rock up, and I looked under the rock, and there was a lot of critters under there that I had to get rid of, and I did, and I was very, very, it is a miracle. For me, it was an amazing miracle. So, as you've heard, I guess you guessed from my accent, I'm from Australia. I was born and raised in Australia born in a place called Moolumbah in northern New South Wales. It's a country town, and was primarily raised in Queensland, which is the pointy bit on the east coast, if you don't know your map of Australia. And I was raised in and around Brisbane and North Queensland in a place called Mackay, which is a sugarcane country. And I grew up pretty much the same as everyone. I enjoyed my sport. I enjoyed rugby, I enjoyed cricket, but I always was always a seeker as well, and I've always had an interest in spiritual matters. I've always had an interest in spiritual matters, and it's my father was is Catholic. He was from an Irish Catholic family, and he went to a private school in Brisbane, and they beat him mercilessly in schools, and he was a staunch atheist. And I can always remember as a child, and I've told this story a couple of times, I can remember there's a in the western suburbs of Brisbane, there's a place called Toowong Cemetery, which is kind of dominates a bit of the landscape out in the west. And there's this big plinth in the cemetery, and it's one of the landmarks. When you're going on the Western Freeway that you're going past Toowong Cemetery. And I always remember in the car with my father when I was young, I must have been 4 or 5, and I knew what the answer was. Well, I kind of knew what a cemetery was, but I asked him, I said, "Dad, what's that there?" And he goes, "That's a cemetery." And I was like, "Oh, okay. What happens in cemeteries?" And he goes, "Oh, that's where they put dead people." I was like, "Oh, right." And then I sort of waited a bit, and I went, "So, Dad, what happens when you die?" And he went, "Nothing. You're dead. It's black. It's finished. It's over." And I remember being absolutely terrified and feeling very, 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 very frightened by that, and feeling, upset. But that didn't stop me from looking down that path, because I don't know if I didn't want to believe it or I couldn't quite believe it, but I kept on doing it through my childhood and into my teens and into my 20s and up until today. And I continued on. And then when I got to my teens, is again, I said, as I said, my mother's side of the family were chronic alcoholics, and my uncles got myself and my brother drunk when we were 9 or 10. And I remember being very sick, but it was also that feeling of being. It enabled me to be an idiot and act like a clown and be a fool. And I kind of took to it like a duck to water. And I realized, I remembered, that that was a way, it was an excuse. And I'd seen adults do it. And it was that whole thing, that leveling of behavior, and that sort of, and when you're born with that kind of chronic low self-esteem or chronic low self-worth, or that you're not quite good enough, alcohol was the great leveler. And it enabled other people to come down to your level, or you to come up to their level somewhere along the line. And it was kind of like a, like Tetris, I guess, and sort of thing. It was sort of, for it was a temporary way of getting rid of that sort of inferiority, and raised me up or brought me down to wherever I should have been. And I just took to it. And by the age of 13 and 14, I was drinking regularly. I was stealing my mother's wine. And in Australia, you'll probably know that if anyone's been there, or they've got these things called flagons, which are these big cardboard casks, which are full of wine. You can get them in Riesling and whatever wine you want. And my brother and I would just be, she'd be pissed, and we'd be filling up our own glasses and drinking this awful stuff called Riesling. It was cheap wine. It was awful, but it got us drunk. And and I've had drinking dreams about those casks, I have, because it was so easily, it was so accessible as a child. And my brother and I'd go to bed pissed all the time, drunk all the time. And it was just going through childhood. And you're going through puberty, and there's all that sort of stuff that comes with puberty, and all the issues that come with, about with girls and stuff like that. And you get kind of, and I became quite angry, and I became angry because my father was quite violent as well. And he abused me in a couple of different ways, mentally, physically. And my mother was, again, was kind of a lush and was totally pissed. And I just, you just grow up with that kind of, that becomes normal. It's the whole normal thing. And I don't know if anyone, I always think of that, if anyone's heard of that, the serial killer in England called Fred West. And he was notorious serial killer that they got about 20 years ago, I think, in outside Birmingham, I think. And they rescued his family, and he had a daughter, and this daughter that he grew up with, and she was aware of all that had gone up, but she just thought that that was life, that perversion and that way of living. She thought that that was normal, and she only worked out that that family life wasn't normal by watching Coronation Street on television. I vividly remember that. And that's how I grew up. And I just grew up and I just assumed that that's the way things were and that I was inherently different to other people. So other people had these kind of like 2.4 families and they seemed to, all these, they seemed to have girlfriends and they had jobs and they had normal fam, no so-called normal families. And, things came normally to them and they were at peace and they didn't have hang-ups and they had didn't have any of that stuff. And but I seemed to do, and that was my lot in life. And I was always less than or different or separate from, the cool people or the people that seemed to have life sorted. I was always different to that. And but that didn't, and I was still doing the spiritual seeking thing, and I've read books about Buddhism and all sorts of different things, and I would read sci-fi and fantasy and anything to escape, anything to escape. And I guess the spiritual seeking was a kind of a way of escape as well, and it was kind of a diversion. And because, lo and behold, I'd do anything to look at myself, I guess, as growing up. And again, it's that whole thing. I was never given the rule book growing up. I was never ever given the rule book. You go to IKEA and you get the instructions for all those really tricky sofas and all that stuff, but I was, I just didn't get that rule book, and everyone else seemed to get the rule book, and I just made it up as I went along. And I made it up by stealing ideas and stealing personalities and stealing concepts from other people, and opinions. And when I had opinions about everything, but there were always other people's that I'd beg, borrowed, and stealed. And I guess in retrospect, that's the way most of us do it. But I certainly, my personality was a patchwork quilt of other people's opinions and ideas and outlooks. And I could steal that from anyone, from characters on television to my father, to my mother, to my brother, to my uncle, to people at school, anything. But I just did, I had no idea of who I was. And those layers were created until I created this kind of this monster. I get well, a monster in most cases it wasn't a monster, but certainly the beast in me would come out when I had a drink, or I'd have a drug, or I'd do anything. The beast in me was always there. And as I said, he was really good at sport, and I was good at rugby and things like that. And I was quite vicious and I was quite nasty. And if I got a drink in me as well, I was vicious and quite nasty. And that's just how it went. And when I was got in my early 20s, I managed to get to university. I was reasonably intelligent, and I managed to get to university. I was quite diligent about stuff when I couldn't be, when I needed to be. And I got to uni somehow. And but I started suffering from depression, or what I thought was depression at the time. And I went away again to find myself. I left university for a year and went traveling to the north of Queensland and worked on a trawler and all sorts of stuff and did all that kind of stuff, which I thought would be really romantic, and it wasn't, because it was hard work and it was graft, and but it was, but it was always the booze was there. The booze and the drugs was always there to alleviate that. If there was any inkling of life's not quite right, quick, drink it away, just, or drug it away, whatever, it's all that stuff. It was just always, the quick fix was always there, was always at hand. And but I managed somehow to graduate from university. I went back and I did it, and I just became a wanderer. I finished university, and I just started wandering, and I started wanting to go traveling again. To, I guess, I don't know if it was a geographical or not. I don't know if anyone here's from Australia, or I guess we got a lass here from New Zealand. Australia's not exactly a cultural hotspot. And that's with the great respect to it. There's certainly, I grew up in Brisbane, which didn't have a great deal. It was a cinema and lots of football and stuff like that, which is nothing wrong with that. But I wanted to see the rest of the world. I wanted to see stuff that I'd seen pictures about and seen on television. So I wanted to go traveling. And I continue to do that to this day. But I came to England and I set up base in England playing sport. And that's where the drink really settled in, because I guess anyone here from Ireland or the UK will know that the Aussie abroad is a notorious figure in London, in particular in Earl's Court and stuff like that. And you can get away with stuff and as an Aussie that you'd never get away with at home. And you can drink yourself and you can be a lout and you can do all that stuff because you play up to it. You indulge that character of the Aussie, you know, the Les Patterson abroad, if anyone knows who Les Patterson is. And I took to it. You know, it was great because it's a great excuse to drink, particularly if you combine rugby, which is, you know, let's face it, rugby is all about drinking. And I just took to it like a duck to water. And, you know, and I got into relationships and stuff like that. And I got married. And I always remember this. I guess this is an Irish-based meeting, but I've told the story a couple of times. But I used to play for Blackburn Rugby Union Club, and we went on a tour to Ireland. And I remember leaving one early Friday morning and getting on the bus in Blackburn, which is in Lancashire, 4,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire, if anyone wants to know the reference. And I got in to the bus, and that's the last thing I remember. And the next thing I remember, I materialized like the TARDIS from Doctor Who, barefoot with no shoes on and no jacket in the middle of winter in Ireland in a forest on the side of a mountain. And I had no idea how I got there. Had absolutely no idea how I got there. I blacked out on the bus. I assume I'd blacked out on the bus. I'd got off. We had a piss stop, as they call it. And I'd wandered off into the woods and lost my shoes trudging through the woods. And I kind of sobered up, or half sobered up, and I was in the middle of nowhere and I thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to absolutely die. And I can remember I saw some lights at the bottom of a valley. So I came rolling down this hill, cut my feet to shreds, and came to the middle of this road. And this VW combi van pulled up. And I stood in the middle of the road waving, and the lights were there in the darkness, in the middle of the night. And this girl sticks her head out the passenger window and goes, "Where you going, mate?" And I was like, "Are you from Australia?" And she goes, "Yeah, I'm from Australia." She says, "Whereabouts are you from?" "I'm from Brisbane." I said, "I'm from Brisbane." "Whereabouts in Brisbane?" I'm from Indooroopilly. And it turns out she lived two streets away from where I was brought up. So she gave me a lift back to Dublin. And I always said this, I always remember, because I staggered back into the hotel and all my mates, my so-called mates, were in the foyer, you know, having a few beers and stuff. And I walked in and I went, "It's okay, guys, I'm all right." And they looked at me and says, "Why? Where have you been?" They had they couldn't really give a fuck about where I was or what I've been doing. But that's just pretty much the way I lived my life. And that blackout thing was a big thing for me. You know, I can vividly remember, you know, material at a Christmas party all of a sudden, then waking up or sort of sobering up in a phone booth somewhere in the middle of where I had no idea how I'd got there, on the phone to my then wife, asking her where I was. And she wouldn't have any idea where I was. You know, it's just because I've just, you know, it had become unmanageable. My life had certainly become unmanageable. And I'd become powerless over alcohol. And come 2002, I hit a rock bottom. I'd hit several rock bottoms leading up to this, but this was the rock bottom that really kind of got me. And my wife decided she didn't want to be with me, and she was going to take my baby son away from me. And I'd lost my job. I'd lost friends, you know, and I'd lost all my self-respect, blah, 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 you know, this whole cliche. But I was at the lowest ebb I've ever been at. It was like, you know, that walking around with your eyes kind of full, like you're going to cry, and that pain in your chest, and that grieving thing in your guts. And that's what I got. I had that grieving in my stomach. And it was the lowest of the low. And I remember getting down on my knees in the house where I was staying at in Bradford. And it was one of those things. I just got on my knees and I just said, "If there's a God up there, you've got to help me, because I can't do this anymore. I just don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen." And that's that last refuge thing. Now, you'll find out later. I'll talk to you later about what I do or I don't believe. But the next day I was in an AA meeting. And that I had no concept of AA the day before. I had no idea about what AA was and what it was about. I had no idea, but I was in an AA meeting. And I went to a living sober meeting, which I thoroughly recommend to anyone who's new in, is to get your hands on the Living Sober book, because I love the Living Sober book, particularly for new days. And it was one of those, I lived by the Living Sober book for the first few months of my sobriety. But I went to this Living Sober meeting and they read, it was the chapter about availing oneself of a sponsor. And I didn't know what a sponsor was, but I remember thinking, that's great. So you've got like somebody who helps you, like a personal kind of coach. And somebody said, yeah, that's what it is. Oh, right. Okay. And then I saw on the word, somebody had mentioned that thing, if you don't have the first drink, you can't get drunk. And that was a cracking for me, because I thought that was genius, because I realized, you know, it was that thing. I could never have one of anything. Like I said, I was a Moorish person. And if I have one hit of anything, I want the rest. And I want more than the rest. And I want to drink it dry. And, you know, and I've been on planes from Australia to England, and you know, and stopped at on Singapore Airlines, and they wouldn't serve me anymore because I've drunk them free of Tiger beer. The Tiger beer was empty because I'd drunk it and was acting like a fool. It's that stuff. I can never have one of anything. And I always say, you know, I can always remember coming home from the pub and there'd be one can of beer left in the fridge and I wouldn't drink it because I know that there wouldn't be any more after it. So I might as well not have any more, because I couldn't get down the bottle shop and I wouldn't be able to buy anymore. It's just things like that. You know, I've got an extreme addictive personality, an extreme one. And even to this day, I have to be mindful about having one of anything. And that just was that realization, you know, and that was that realization in that meeting. If I don't have the first one, don't have the first drug, don't have the first drink, don't have the first whatever, the dominoes won't start falling. So that was a realization, because that's where I found identification. Somebody was talking about that and I thought, that's really good. I saw all those things about the steps on the wall and that looked really complicated. And they were talking in a different language, you know, it was a different language, but there was something, they were talking about their feelings. People in that meeting were talking about their feelings. They were talking about kind of truth. And it's that whole thing, you know, when you're a seeker, in my sense, it's like they were talking about deep and meaningful stuff that really, I just thought, this is great. This is great, because I didn't want to be there, because I was going to leave after 5 minutes. You know, I was going to sit up the back, wait till the meeting started, then sort of skulk out. And but somebody, as I always say, somebody who's still in the fellowship that I know now offered me a cup of tea when I first walked in. And that was really important for me, because if she didn't do that, I don't think I would have stayed. And that's why I always give everyone a welcome, no matter if we've got Zoom meetings, and I'll put my details in the chat of the home group. But everyone gets a warm welcome, and I think it's so important, whether it's face-to-face or Zoom, that everyone should be greeted. Because, you know, I have been in meetings in different parts of the world, in London, where I've shown up in a Zoom meeting. Nobody knew me from a bar of soap, and nobody said a word to me. And if I was a newcomer, I would just thought, well, these people aren't very nice, they aren't very caring. So it's that thing. It's about having empathy in AA, because I think, or NA or wherever, because we soon forget. And I've been guilty of this myself, is that we forget what it was like when we come in. You know, we build up, we become a somebody in the different fellowships, we get a few years under our belt or a few months under our belt, and it's very easy for alcoholics to forget what it was like when we come in, the terror, the psychic horror, and the low self-esteem that we have. And we lose that empathy, because in the early days, you know, you're desperate for anyone to just be nice to you. And, you know, if there's a newcomer in, or anyone comes in that I've never seen, I'll make sure. Even in, you know, I've just been in, I was in Los Angeles a little while ago, and I went into a meeting and I'd never been there before, but I saw somebody sitting on his shelf and I gave him, shook his hand and said hello. And it turns out it was the first time he was at that meeting. So it's that we have a responsibility to the newcomer in every sense. And it can be as simple as, for me, shaking the hands and making sure they stay, and making sure, because I've been in their shoes, and it's remembering that. Because again, I'm guilty of it. Everyone's guilty of being big shots in AA and NA, you know, and there's a lot of them. There's a lot of bleeding deacons. So, you know, I'm always mindful. I try and keep that humility and try and remember that. And that's not, I'm not preaching there, by the way, but I'm just saying. So after my first meeting, I just had that epiphany. And I remember driving away from that meeting thinking, you know what? I was relieved. I had a sense of relief because I'm an alcoholic. And I kind of knew what was wrong with me, that feeling of never fitting in, never being part of anything, having that chronic low self-esteem, and most obviously is the way that they drank and the way I drank and the way I took drugs was I identified with what people are saying, and it was like boom, you know, it was like the light bulbs were going off, you know, it was amazing. And I remember hitting the steering wheel going, I'm an alcoholic. And it was an epiphany. And that was kind of my step one was done there, you know, because I accepted it. I accepted that I was an alcoholic and I could say that word and that my life was totally unmanageable because I was ready to give up. You know, I'd had enough. I'd been beaten to a pulp by my actions and by life and by my drinking. I'd been, by that self-will, I'd been beaten to a pulp. And I kept on coming, you know, I kept on coming to AA and I've always made it, and I just started getting to a load of meetings and I started hunting in packs with, you know, other lads, other people who were new in, and we'd drive around to different meetings all around the country and all around the region. And we just started, you know, going to different meetings, and that was really cool. And you'd pick them up and there was a camaraderie and that fellowship. That satsang was happening. You talk about stuff before the meeting, which is really important. During the meeting was cool. You'd sort of talk the business and you'd carry the message. Then after the meeting, you'd have a cup of coffee and some cookies and some bickies and whatever, and you became a gang, and it was great. And I always remember that. And slowly but surely, you start getting your life back. And was a big thing for me is, you know, I started getting my life back, and I started to get my wife back and my child back. And I remember after about 3 or 4 months, I started slipping off the meetings. By this stage I'd had a sponsor who was a Kiwi, by the way, by Stu, and who rang me one day, and because he'd known I hadn't shown up to a meeting, and he just said to me, "What are your intentions with AA? Are you serious about it?" And I was like, "Oh, yes." He challenged me. And that was really good of him, because again, it's one of those things. We're so lucky that we stay around in AA, because you know, I always think I use this analogy, and rightly or wrongly, but it's like, you know, you've seen those nature programs where those mother turtles, those giant sea turtles come up on the beach and they lay like 1,000 eggs and they cover them up with their flippers and they go back out. And then a few months later, the little hatchlings come out, and all over down the beach, there's like millions of these tiny little turtles, baby turtles, go out into the ocean. And it's something like one comes back out of 10,000. And I think those figures are pretty accurate for AA in a lot of ways, because I know that there's people who don't come back after the first meeting. And then I know there's people who don't come back after 3 meetings. And I know there's people who don't come back after 6 months. And there's people who don't come back after 1 year and 2 years and 5 years and 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And there's people. So we are the people who hang around are the bigger turtles who end up coming back to lay the eggs and carry the message. And I think that's what happens. There's all through my sobriety, there's been instances and flashpoints and sliding door moments where I've stayed in AA, and somebody's reached out to me again, who's reached out to me, who said stuff or called me on my bullshit and said, "You know what? You're going to hang around." And, you know, I can vividly remember, I think I was at 9 years sober, and I'd been going to the same meeting for a while, and the same people were talking. And I can vividly remember this, a woman that I knew who said the same story all the time. And she was asked to do the main share. And I just remember standing up, walking out, just thinking, "I don't want to hear this anymore." And I'd fallen out of love with AA. And that's simply what it was. Because for me, I was in love with AA. And it's like any relationship, I fell out of love with AA. And I had to have a trial separation. And that happened for a year. And I would like to say that, you know, I was fine, but I wasn't. I wasn't fine. I didn't drink, but I certainly went doolally. I certainly went egotistical. I certainly became selfish and aggressive. And because I know it was being part of that web of AA, it stretches me out and squeezes out all the self-will and all the delusion and all the illusion that I have about myself and that I think about the world. And up until that point, and so I dropped out of that web and I'd sort of become separate from AA. And because I thought I deserved life and I should do it better. And I just slowly but surely fell away from it. And it was only my sponsor at that stage who, after in 10 years of sobriety, said, "Will you come and do a main chair at my local ex-home group?" I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, sure. And he'd always kept in touch with me, but he knew what I was like, you know what I mean? But and I came and did that main share, and I remember it was like sitting in a room full of Japanese, and I had no idea what the language was, and I had to tell the story, and I felt like a fraud because I was basically had to tell people that I'd fallen out of love with AA, and they were very gracious and they were very kind. But you know what? I went back the next week, and I went back the week after, and I slowly but surely fell back in love with AA. And it was a great lesson for me. And I'm looking back, I was so lucky that I kept on coming back. I kept on coming back. And again, it's that little turtle. That little turtle got another opportunity. He survived the shark attack or the seagull or whatever, but he'd survived and he'd kept on going. And I've continued on to this day. Just on the seeking thing, because I know this is a secular meeting, I love the secular side of AA, and I love the secular side of recovery. It's important for me because I don't know what to believe. You know what I mean? It's funny because I was thinking about it on the way when Mark asked me to come and be really about this, is talk about this because and to really identify what it is for me, is that, all I know, if I take away all the belief and all the stuff that I've read about, or you read about in a Bible, or you read about in the Quran, or you read about in this, all that's hearsay. It's hearsay. In a court of law, it's all hearsay. Unless I was there, everything is hearsay. And I had this. I was living in Ireland last year. I lived in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, near Belfast for 6 months. And I just remember walking on this beach and just, thinking about this stuff. Because I'd been through some all sorts of stuff that had happened to me. I'd had my son had tried to kill himself. My mother had died. Blah blah, blah all that stuff that happens in life, And I'd faced everyone, I'd faced everything as a grown up, as we do in AA. When we've been around for a while, we face it as a grown up. And I just remember thinking, you know what? I don't know anything. All I know is that I'm present, and that I'm conscious, and that I'm alive. And that this picture show, there is somebody witnessing this picture show. And that's as good as it gets. And that, for me, was a revelation. And it was like, oh. And that was it. Now, I know there's been some spooky shit that's happened in my life, and there's been coincidences. Like I say, meeting an Indooroopilly girl from Brisbane in the middle of the countryside in Ireland on a dark, wintry night. Was that a coincidence? I don't know. Maybe it could have been, maybe not. I don't know. And I always think about there's a few, I beg, borrow, and steal a lot of stuff from a lot of places. And there's a couple of things that really strike, for me are important. I believe in step two, and step two in the sense that I'm willing and that I'm open-minded. And that's for me what free thinking is about. It's just being open-minded, because I know that there's people who are so open-minded, they're closed-minded, and they don't accept anyone else's belief. And once I have, for me, if I start believing in something, anything, whether it's a religion, a football team, a political movement, whatever, that starts creating an ego for me, and it nails me down. And I start nailing my colors to the mast. For me, I can get drawn into arguments, I can get drawn into fights, and I can start having an opinion on stuff, which is fucking dangerous for an alcoholic. It's dangerous for me to have an opinion on anything. So I try not to now. And it's a great way of living. And so step two is really, I blur between step two, step three, six, seven, eight, and nine when I've got to 10, and then 11 for me is great. And I do tw step 12, as some of you know, I do a lot of step 12. I do an awful lot of step 12, and I have done for the last 2 years. And I always remember, and always, I think about what they said, when Buddha was around, and I think they'd couple of his so-called disciples had come to him and says, "What happens when you die? What happens when you get enlightened? And what happens when you die?" And Buddha just went, "I don't fucking know." Good answer. And that's pretty much the same for me. I don't know. I don't know. And I'm really happy with that I don't know anything. All I know is that I'm an alcoholic, that I can't drink, and that I can't have one drink one day at a time. And I do these steps. And then the spooky stuff happens. That's when the spooky stuff happens, because good stuff happens. I get a life. I got a relationship that's healthy. I've got friends all over the world. I get to travel. I've just spent 2.5 months in the US traveling around, which has been awesome. I lived in Ireland for, like I say, last year, and I travel around and been there. I've been to Spain, and I can do that stuff. I've got the freedom to do stuff, and I can And I guess, and the irony is, if anyone's read the Gnostic Gospels according to Jesus, the ones that they weren't allowed to put in the Bible, and there was one thing that he said, Jesus said, in all things, try and be a passerby. And for me, that's pretty cool. And try to be a passerby and not have an opinion. Now, whether or not that works for you or it doesn't, I'm open-minded. It might be right, it might be wrong, I don't know. But that's for me is, that's where happy, being open-minded and getting rid of this head and doing the steps and shredding away this self, because for me, that's where the anonymous thing comes in, whether it's AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, or Narcotics Anonymous. Anonymity comes when I shred the semblances of self, and there's no Dave, there's no David, there's nothing. I'm just a member who tries to carry the message to other alcoholics. So, and that's free thinking, you know, meant free thinking. That's for me is free thinking. And so, yeah, it's good. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you very much for asking me. And it's wonderful. Cheers.